This is the San Joaquin Sound Podcast. I'm your host, AJ Rodriguez. This podcast is about music in Bakersfield and the surrounding San Joaquin Valley. Today, I'm here with Billy Haynes, a talented bassist, vocalist, and sometimes guitarist. He had an incredible career from playing here in Bakersfield with his band, The Original Souls, to touring the world with Tina Turner, Lou Rawls, Pressure Point, playing the Hollywood Bowl, Carnegie Hall, and even a Cambodian orphanage.
Good one, man.
So before we get into your career, let's go back to where it started. Your great-grandfather was a guitarist, right?
Yes, he was.
What was he like?
He was sort of the gut bucket blues guy. He was a church guy.
Oh, yeah.
But he really played that Lightning Hopkins style guitar with, you know, the thumb pick and...
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it was quite interesting. He was the guitarist for the Church of God in Christ on Brundage and King Street.
That's cool. What was his name?
E.L. Smith, Elijah Smith. And and the thing about it back in those days is that the band used to rehearse at our house. And I used to get upset because they would mess with my cartoon time. But little did I know that the influences of their music were influencing me as a young fella. I appreciate that it happened.
That's awesome. I watched a short interview you did with CSUB, and I noticed at the beginning you were playing the song Grandma's Hands by Bill Withers. I think because of your childhood, that must have a special meaning, that song to you, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Actually it was my great grandmother. She raised me, and the lyrics to that song were pretty much like she was. You know, she was always my rock, my anchor. And, you know, she played a tambourine.
That's cool.
As well. So that's why the song means a lot to me.
Means a lot to me, too, because it reminds me of my grandma, Rodriguez. And a lot of the things in the song also mirror how she was, her personality. And, you know, even it says in the song, you know, Billy, don't you run too fast. And that's your name, too.
Might fall on a piece of glass.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah, for sure. Everywhere I do it, I mean, from Europe to America, people can relate to the song.
Yeah.
So it's a great song.
What was your grandma like? What kind of music did she like?
She was part of the church as well. And so it was all gospel music back in the day in our home. So we had an upright piano, and she played piano, and she sang, and she played tambourine, and they were very much a part of the church. So there was always, like I said, the band rehearsing there, and then they would have prayer meetings and they would sing. So it was, you know, a big influence on me coming up.
So you grew up in the 50s and 60s. On the podcast, we talked only a little bit about that era in regards to country music. But what was growing up in Bakersfield like for you in the 50s and 60s?
Well, for me, growing up in Bakersfield was quite an adventure. I was a different kind of guy. I had a bicycle, and so by the time I was 8 years old, I was selling papers downtown Bakersfield.
Wow.
And I used to, I was kind of a, I was hard to handle. But I remember going to the El Tejon Hotel back in those days.
Where was that at?
That was on the corner of Chester and Truxton.
Cool.
The El Tejon Hotel. And that's where they recorded, that's where actually KERO Channel 23 had their studios.
Oh, yeah.
And I used to go and sneak in and watch the Cousin Herb show.
Oh, you cool. Know? Live recorded then.
Right.
That's cool.
As they were recording the show. And I always went to the Weatherby's Telethon, which was hosted by Cousin Herb.
Okay.
And I used to actually get up on stage. He would have, you know, people come up on stage and sing. And I'd jump. I was pretty wild. And with my bicycle, I could get all over Bakersfield.
Sometimes the bicycle is the ticket to get everywhere.
It was my ticket to freedom, bro.
Back then, Lakeview was part of the Mayflower District, is what they call it now. And that was during a time of segregation, right? How you lived through that, what was that like?
Well, I mean, it was obvious that we couldn't go down Edison Highway to any of those places, and we certainly couldn't go to the Blackboard or Trout's or anything like that. But, I mean, that was never anything that I wanted to do because that's not the style of music I like. I mean, there's two incidents in my childhood that I remember vividly where white people would come into our neighborhood. And I remember, you know, being called the N-word and having some white guy drive by real fast, and I got hit in the head with a pork chop bone.
Oh, my gosh.
And then another time, a white guy came, you know, how kids are in the streets, you know, especially back in those days because there was no internet or anything. And he poured milk over my head when I went up to the car. That kind of stuff. I mean, it was a lot of that. And then especially during the Christmas parade, you know, you had to, you know, it was after dark. And then you'd have to be real careful getting out of the white community to get back across Union Avenue. But, I mean, I was used to it because I was on my bike all the time. But I was always weary of people, of cars, especially of younger people. You know, it's tough, man.
I read you got to see James Brown when you were just 10 years old, and mm-hmm. it really affected you. What was that like?
One of the band members that my cousin played with, a saxophone player by the name of Philip Castaneda. If you notice, I'm putting all these names out because these are unsung heroes of Bakersfield.
We love it. And, I love it, I should say.
And I think at that time, if you could see on that poster right there, children under 12 was 99 cents to see James Brown.
Wow.
So he took me to see James Brown when I was 10 years old. And it was unbelievable to me what I saw. And even though I was 10, it inspired me to want to play music. It really did. It just inspired me to want to be a part of that type of show. Throughout my whole career, I played a lot of James Brown music.
Yeah. Was that at the Albert S. Good
Auditorium?
Albert
S. Good.
Yeah, I printed out that flyer.
Oh, well, that doesn't necessarily mean it was this particular show.
I know there was two. I don't know.
He was always in town. I mean, we used to go see him every year, especially after they opened the Civic.
Oh, wow.
You know?
Yeah. That particular flyer, I saw someone named Eugene Moles post online, and I know his dad was Gene Moles, who mm-hmm. was an important Bakersfield artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this wasn't the show I seen because there was, I know about Bobby Bird, but there was no opening acts like this Anna King and Johnny and Bill, the show I seen. But I mean, James Brown came to Bakersfield every year.
That's awesome.
Every year. That is so cool, man.
You're welcome to keep that one.
Oh, thank you. I didn't want to ask, but thank you so much. Albert S. Good. Yeah, this was before the Civic was built.
Yeah, Albert S. Good is at the fairgrounds, mm-hmm. right? The big artists would play there about mm-hmm.
then. Because I was not a very good student in high school. And so I was the class clown. So I would get kicked out of, you know, for semesters at a time.
Wow, whole semesters?
Whole semesters. And Johnny Gomez, unfortunately, had Valley Fever. And so he was at home all the time. And Johnny Gomez, he was one of the renowned guitar players of Bakersfield. In jazz and R&B. And so we lived in the same hood, you might say. And my cousin was a bass player. And, you know, so I knew some of the local, by him being a bass player, I knew some of the musicians like Willie Herrera, who was a saxophone player, Nino Macias, all of these people would come by our house. And then when I found out that Johnny had Valley Fever, I would go visit him during the day, and he would teach me how to play guitar. I started getting good at it, and so he took me under his wing, and he introduced me to the Paradons, so I started being the bass player for the Paradons. That's how I got into being a bass player, and, you know, we did television shows on Sunday morning with Don Rodewald,
Don Rodewald's The Afternoon Show on KER 23. That's the one. And so that was with the Paradons you were with.
Mm-hmm.
What was the show like? How long was it?
It was a variety show. And I probably at the end of the show, they would have music.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. I can't remember. It's been so long ago.
No worries.
I just know we did it.
Yeah.
And but we were there, I think, almost, it seemed like almost every Sunday.
Wow. That's cool.
Mm-hmm. Right. And also, I think, you know, once, you know, we had our own band, we did his show as well with the Original Souls.
Nice. All right. So we talked about Johnny Gomez. I know I read that Luther Davis also helped you. How did he help you?
You have to understand, you know, that's a long time ago.
Yeah, don't worry.
Okay, but no, it's starting to make sense. It's starting to make sense. Yeah, I got it wrong. What happened was, is that, you know, when Johnny Gomez had Valley Fever,
okay,
I would go over there. He would teach me how to play guitar. And then I met Luther Davis. How I met Luther, there was a band called The Diamonds, and they were working at the Kern County Fair, and Luther and I got up on stage and sat in with them and sang What I Say.
Nice.
That was kind of like when I wanted to be in show business. And at that time, Luther was in a band called the Mark Five, which was a Mexican band. And they played, you know, cumbias and corridos and, you know, but they also played R&B. And they would let me come in and sing two or three R&B songs. And when they'd get paid, if they, you know, if they made $20.35, well, they would all give me the 35 cents. That would be my pay. And what happened was Robert Calvillo, the bass player of that band, got drafted to Vietnam. And Robert says, well, I want you to take my place, and I'm leaving you my bass guitar and my amp.
Wow.
To take, you know, to play with this band. And that's how I learned how to play bass, from the knowledge that I got from Johnny Gomez. And once I started playing bass is when I hooked back up with Gomez to start playing with the Paradons, and he was the one that got me the job at the Cotton Club. Put it in the correct timeline is a little difficult at this time in life.
Yeah.
You know?
That makes sense. I have two names that I wanted to ask you about, and I don't really know the era this is exactly. Who's Good Time Charlie?
That's Good Time Charlie right there.
Okay.
That's Good Time Charlie.
And what band is that right there?
That's Good Time Charlie. I don't remember what he called the band, but it was Good Time Charlie and somebody. Impalas. The Royal Impalas.
Royal Impalas. That's a cool name.
The Royal Impalas.
And then something, Elsie Killebrew?
Elsie Killebrew.
Who's that?
Elsie Killebrew was probably the best drummer in Bakersfield.
Wow.
As a matter of fact, he's in that band right there as well. Elsie Killebrew was just, well, he was with Good Time Charlie.
Yeah.
That day. I mean, yeah, actually, you know, you can't really say that somebody was in this one particular band.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, everybody floated.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, to whoever needed a drummer that day, you know, Elsie would go, you know, that's just whoever had the gig. And, but Elsie Killebrew, I'll never forget, back in those days, the pawn shop had brand new drum sets for like $125 with these terrible sounding cymbals and everything. And that was his drum set, but man, he could play it. He was just really, really, in fact, he reminded me of Jabbo Starks from the James Brown Band.
Wow.
That's how he played. Yeah, Elsie Killebrew, just an amazing drummer.
I think before you started playing with all these bands, you were playing in some Mexican-American bands, mm-hmm, in like the Juarez Hall, the Druid, mm-hmm, Hall, and the Fraternal Hall, you said?
Well, yeah, that's when I got with Luther Davis. Luther Davis, like I said, was playing in with the Mark V. And the Mark V went from Mark V to the Mark VI to the Mark VII, you know, depending on how many guys they had. I really, you know, I wasn't a bass player at that time with them. I was just like this featured singer.
Okay.
That would come in. You know, we would do the Waters and the Starlight Roller Rink. They'd have dances that lasted till 5 and 6 in the morning. That was on Kentucky Street. You know, I even sang Mexican songs like Creí and, you know, stuff like that. But yeah, that's how I started, you know, getting into the band thing. But, you know, what changed was when Robert got drafted and they needed a bass player. And so I started working on that skill. And then once I started getting good at that, I started to stretch out on my own, you know, I started my own band and I was pretty aggressive, you know, so I didn't like taking orders from people. And so I would say right around 67, right around 66, 67, I started putting together my own bands. I first started playing in around 63. Yeah, as a freshman in high school, that's when I met Luther. And Luther, you know, he was in that Mexican band, and that's where I cut my teeth, you know, being on stage, was with that Mexican band, the Mark Five.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And so then how did you start playing soul music?
You know, Johnny Gomez was already into the blues, and he was already into the Paradons, and they were singing that kind of stuff. And when they needed a bass player, he called me.
Yeah.
And then that's how I started getting, you know, more involved into the R&B thing, is with Johnny and the Paradons. And then once, you know, I kind of cut my teeth on that, is when I met some guys, you know, local guys my age that were into James Brown. I mean, we were the James Brown fanatics.
Yeah.
Of that time. I put together a group called the Original Souls. It was Johnny Diosdado, Ron Goosby, Rod Rodriguez. In fact, I was just talking to him today, and myself.
What about Jack Swift and Mike Bonilla? Or is that later?
You know, when you think about it, it's not a whole bunch later.
Okay.
It was like maybe 6 or 7 months after that. What had happened was, you know, we were kind of making a name with ourselves, but, you know, we still just, you know, we weren't really making it. And then we heard about this Filipino-Mexican drummer from Lamont by the name of Richard Rugnow, who was a great singer and a great drummer. And he was working with this band called the Majestics. And so we went to one of their gigs, a house party or something, and we saw him, and we just flipped. You know, we recruited him. You know, we stole him from the Majestics and said, man, you need to come with us. And then that's when we added Mike Bonilla, and we added Jack Swift to our band. And then that's when we won the Battle of the Bands in 1969 at Lake Ming. And we went on to the Hollywood Bowl, and we won there as well, which led to us opening for Gary Puckett and the Union Gap.
Awesome.
Well, we've gone past the Cotton Club.
Yeah, yeah, don't worry. I'm going to circle us back. So we talked a lot about some of the groups that were playing.
Mm-hmm.
What places were around back then? I know the Cotton Club and the Elks Club, and then there were some of the dance halls.
Mm-hmm.
What else was there?
There was a club out in a town on Cottonwood. Well, actually, it's Lakeview Avenue. Lakeview is north of Brundage, and Cottonwood Road is south of Brundage. And there's a town back then.
Carversville?
Carversville.
Oh, yeah, the Squeeze Inn.
Yeah, the Squeeze Inn. And for some reason, they used to have a lot of out-of-town blues musicians. And so, you know, I wasn't really that much of a blues fanatic at that time. But every once in a while, you know, people would say, man, you need to go check so-and-so and so-and-so. And you would go out to the Squeeze Inn. But the Squeeze Inn was a little dangerous. It was a lot more dangerous than actually Cottonwood.
What, but the Cotton Club?
Yeah, it was a lot more dangerous than the Cotton Club. You know, I don't know. I guess because I was young and, you know, I was part of the band, I never, ever felt any kind of, I was never afraid to be around there.
You know?
And And it was really, I mean, there's this one picture of this guy right here, this white guy, and his name is Andy Kernberger. He used to play at the Cotton Club all the time. They called him Blue-Eyed Soul. They loved him. They loved him. So it wasn't that bad, as some people may think it was. Maybe, people talk about moms and pool hall and things like that. Now, those were dangerous places. And I don't know how they figured that they were music venues. They were not.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. I mean, Robert Price did a story about this, and it's also even before then, there was another story in the Californian that mentioned Delwood and Mom's Place as music venues that had a bunch of artists playing, but that's not true, is it? We should correct the record.
Yeah, I would say I could correct the record to say that there was no music going on in Delwood's, and Delwood's was a pool hall. And Mom's was, I know Mom's had a hotel. The only thing, now let me set the record straight here. The musicians that, from the Chitlin circuit that would come into town to play at the Cotton Club would stay at Mom's.
Yeah.
I guess it did have somewhat of a music affiliation.
I see.
But they weren't performing there. They slept there. That's the difference. Unless, now, let me say this. I left Bakersfield in 1976. But by that time, Cottonwood Road, Lakeview Avenue, or whatever you call it now, is, it was getting a little dangerous. There was a lot more guns starting to happen. There wasn't, back in my day, there wasn't a lot of guns going on.
Yeah, here's this picture of Lakeview Avenue in the 1950s and two pictures of people at the Cotton Club playing, if you want to see. It's from the Bakersfield Californian article in 2001.
Oh, I wish I could see the musicians in the back.
Yeah. If you look at the bottom, it says it's from the Daniels collection, from Daniels.
John McDaniels.
So. I don't know where the photos are now.
Oh, my goodness. I can see him standing behind the bar. He was a tall man, about 6'3", 6'4".
Yeah, so we should talk about the Cotton Club. He was the owner of the Cotton Club, right?
Yes. He was a fireman. So, obviously, he had enough money to buy that club. But he was a great guy.
John McDaniels, right?
Yes, yes. I'll never forget him. One thing in time in particular. Oh, wow, there's Sylvester. Backing up Johnny Guitar Watson. Go on, Sylvester. This guy, you see this guy right here?
Yeah.
That's the same dude right there.
Oh, that's cool.
That's the same dude. That's Sylvester Lyons.
That's awesome.
Sylvester Lyons. He was a great bass player. Just he liked his alcohol too much.
Uh-oh.
But he was a great bass player. Go on, Sylvester. Yeah, they were you're going to make me cry, man.
I'm sorry.
You're going to make me cry.
And those are the only photos I could find. I'm sure there's maybe some around in private collections, but as far as I could find, that was everything.
God. Wow, what a trip. He's playing bass. He's backing up Johnny Guitar Watson. And see, that's the reason why I was able to become the bass player in the house band, because the alcohol, he was just, sometimes he would just be passed out, unfortunately,
And you'd get the call.
Yeah.
So the Cotton Club is a stop for the Chitlin Circuit, right?
Right.
Which we should talk about. I don't think most people know what the Chitlin Circuit is, so I'll let you explain it. What is the Chitlin Circuit?
The Chitlin Circuit is black clubs throughout America. And I won't say the South. They call it the Chitlin Circuit, but it's Chicago, Central Avenue. Central Avenue was you know, the chitlet circuit, but I mean, obviously it was much bigger. But what they would do is like how the chitlet circuit worked, they would do the major venues like San Francisco, LA, but they would make their traveling money stopping in places like Bakersfield and Fresno, working their way up to the larger venues.
Yeah, so and it's like a tour route.
Right.
For exactly. All these musicians.
Right. That's exactly what it was. And well, as you can see, what they would do, they would use local musicians to back him up. The name, like Johnny Guitar Watson. Johnny Guitar Watson was, you know, he was big.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day. But people like, I mean, like Bobby Bland. I saw Bobby Bland at the Cotton Club. I saw, you know, Tina Turner. Not, I didn't see Tina Turner, but she was there.
Yeah.
And also the Crusaders. Remember the Crusaders?
I can't say that I do specifically. Okay. I heard Etta James played there.
Oh, yeah.
That's just... And right. Okay, so we should talk about how big the Cotton Club is. It's not very big. It was like 100 people that it fit or so.
You know, man, I really couldn't, you know, I couldn't say right now. I mean, when I was 15, 16, 17, you know, 18 years old, it seemed like a big place. It was,
yeah.
It was two levels.
Two levels, like one's the stage, one's the...
No. They when you walk into the Cotton Club... There was this one level, you know, the bar. When you walk in, the bar was on the left, and you had all these tables here. And then you walk down a couple of steps, which was kind of like the dance floor, but it still had tables on the side, and people would dance right there, and then you'd have the stage
there.
Yeah, so it was, capacity-wise, I really couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
You know.
I heard it had a store, too.
Like there was a liquor store.
That was just nothing to do with it.
Well,
because in an article it says this is another thing. Like I want to correct the record. It says that the Cotton Club was a combination grocery store, pool hall, and dance club. Is that true?
No. Well, unless they did it after I left in 76.
Yeah. As far as from this, up to 1976, of course.
Right. Up to 1976, because I've worked the Cotton Club. A lot, even when I wasn't, you know, backing up, even when I got, you know, with my band.
Yeah.
You know, we would play the Cotton Club. And the only thing I remember about the Cotton Club is that when you walk out to the door, 10 feet right there was a liquor store.
Okay.
Right there. It was just.
It wasn't even physically connected.
No, it was physically. It was part of the building.
Yeah. But, I mean, okay.
But I don't know. Is the Cotton Club? Well, I wasn't there in the '50s, so it looked. This looks a lot more rural than it was in.
Yeah.
You know.
That makes sense. Yeah, I think the building's still there, but I'm not sure.
No, it's there. It's there.
Yeah, it's that guitar instruction, some type of. Music instruction place that teaches guitar.
I would love to go inside and see if it's, you know, pretty much the same. Oh, man, I love this picture here.
They're yours.
Oh, man, thank you so much. I love this picture of Sylvester Lyons. That is so cool. I learned a lot from him. I really did. Ooh, I would love to see John McDaniel's photo library.
So what were some of the best shows that you remember at the Cotton Club?
Man, there was a guy, you know, I wouldn't say that he's famous, but his name was Baby Sid.
Okay.
And Baby Sid was a B3 organ player.
Ooh, like a Hammond type
Hammond
thing?
B3 organ nice. Player with the pedals and everything, and he would carry his B3 in a hearse. He lived in Los Angeles, and he'd come up periodically and just blow the house down. You know, he was just amazing. Another one, and I'm talking about not the unknown ones, the ones you don't hear about. And there was another one. I tell you, there was this singer named Miss Dakota, and Miss Dakota sounded exactly like Etta James.
Wow!
And I remember backing, you know, being backing her up, just like Sylvester backed up Johnny Guitar Watson, you know. So, I mean, that was our job, to back up these people out of L.A. or whatever. And I remember, you know, Miss Dakota was fine, you know, and we were backing, you know, we were backing her up. And, you know, me being young, I'm going, ooh, you know. And right at the finale of the show, she goes into her breasts and pulls out an apple. And pulls out another piece of fruit and then takes off the wig, and it was a man.
Wow, a drag show.
It was a drag show. It was a drag show in the 60s in Bakersfield, California.
That's so cool.
You know, it was traumatizing for me.
Oh, because you were a bit in love.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, but I mean, after I got over my trauma, she took me out. You know, we ate it. The thing I remember so much about working at the Cotton Club is that you always, after the gig, you go eat at the Royal Palms Cafe.
Nice. Where was that? Was that close?
That was on Union and 3rd Street.
Okay.
Well, the Royal Palms, I think the Royal Palms is still, it's still there.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, it was kind of, you know, it had a nice little coffee shop and everything, and the artists would go there and eat after the gig if they either went back to L.A. or, you know, after the show, or stayed at mom's or whatever, but that's where they would go to eat. And see, who else was, well, I mean, like I said, Bobby Bland and the Crusaders and all the named acts, but there was a lot of unknown acts that were coming out of L.A. that were just amazing. But the two that come in mind is Miss Dakota and Baby Sid.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, I did a lot of research, and there's all these amazing concerts, and the Bakersfield Californian, as far as I can see, didn't cover it at all. So it's good to hear about it. So talk to me about the original Souls. How did you start out playing clubs and work your way up?
Well, the original Souls, that was a high school band.
Okay.
You know, that I graduated in 67, and that band had been together for, you know, since like 66. So maybe, you know, I was like a junior or something like that. But we played a lot of high school dances, and we did weddings and that type of stuff. To me, you know, I think we were like Sly and the Family Stone on a local level, because like I said, we had two black guys, myself and Ron Goosby, and we had Johnny Diosdado and Mike Bonilla, and then we had Richard Rugnow, who was half Filipino and half Mexican, and we had Jack Swift, who was white. And then we also had, after Jack Swift, we had a guy named Phil Johnson, another white guy. So we were a mixed band, but our fan base was the East Side.
Oh, wow.
A friend of mine, a guy named Mario Rodriguez, who I grew up with in the hood, he worked for KCEOC, and he got me a job as a summer director. Remember, they have those places where kids could go. And,
yeah, like summer camp type stuff.
Know, yeah, rec centers and things like that. I had this job where I would, at this house where kids could come and play, you know, shuffle pool or whatever, we would practice. You know, that was where we would practice. And the whole neighborhood of all the kids, and it was actually in the Loma. It was on Burger Street, I believe, in the Loma. And we would practice there, and all of the kids from the Loma would come. And then I got a job working at Jefferson School, where, you know, they'd have the, you know, the rec center. And we would practice there, and all of the kids from the Loma would come and watch us play. Rather than, you know, they'd play, and then on Sundays we would go play at Heritage Park. When we signed up for that Broadway Battle of the Bands at Lake Ming, it was 13 bands, and most of those bands were white bands, and they had horn sections, and they had this, and they had that. I'll never forget it. When we went to go play out there at that Battle of the Bands, that place was full of Hispanic people, our fan base, you know. And if you read the write-up, it said it was the largest crowd ever at Lake Ming for that time period.
Yeah.
And I can tell you without a shadow of a doubt that two-thirds of those people were our fan base.
Yeah. It said in the article, I read that it was 3,000 to 4,000 people.
Right.
And Bakersfield didn't even have 200,000 people yet, I don't think.
Right.
So that would have been 2%, roughly. Like, that's like 2% of the population of Bakersfield was at Lake Ming that night watching this concert. It's crazy. It's cool.
Mm-hmm. And see, we were the pride of the East Side. We were the pride of the East Side. So they went out there to support us. And man, I can tell you, I mean, to this day, of all the things that I've done, that is one of the highlights of my career, because it meant so much to the people, you know, to the Hispanic community on the East Side, and the blacks too. You know, we were the pride of Bakersfield. I mean, it wasn't about, to me, that whole thing was not about music. It was about social. And especially with all the racism in Bakersfield and the oppression and everything, and to have their band win the prize.
Yeah, that's awesome.
You know, it was amazing. And it didn't matter, you know, like this fraternal hall riot or whatever they call it. I'll never forget it, because we were the band that was playing there that night.
Oh, yeah. We should talk about that. So in July of 1969, you played at the grand opening of the fraternal hall. 2 weeks later, you go back. And what happens?
Well, wow. Where'd you get that information?
It's from Daniel Rios's thesis.
Okay. Well, I can say this. What I remember about that day is that we played at Heritage Park. And what we used to do at Heritage Park, we would just go and we'd set up and we'd start playing. And the whole park would fill up. It would just fill up. And we would play for beer money. And then we had a gig that night at Fraternal Hall.
And where was that at, the Fraternal Hall?
It's on California Avenue, close to Union Avenue.
It's still there?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
The great part about that is that all of the people that were at Heritage Park that day, they all paid to go to that dance that night. They just, you know, they took a little break or whatever they did. And they, you know, when we left the park and, you know, we were young, so we could just go play and pack up and then go do the gig. And
these were young people, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, teenagers.
Yeah. Teenagers. Yeah. This was young people. And, but we had such a tremendous following that they would go hear us play for free in the daytime and then go and pay to go see us play that night. And I remember it was packed. We never played to an empty house. And I remember them coming up to the stage and saying, "You guys need to stop. You guys need to stop playing." And we go, "Okay." And so we go outside. I mean, and there was no violence. There was absolutely no violence. I can tell you this with all honesty, that when we played, it was a love-in, man. We never had any trouble or any fights or anything like that. But that night, after they told us to stop, we all went outside to go see what was going on. And right in front, you had all of the people that were inside, standing outside in front of the fraternal hall. And there was a row of cops in riot gear on the other side of California Avenue. And some idiot threw a beer bottle in the middle of the road. It wasn't even close to hitting any cop. And when he threw that beer bottle in the middle of the road, they came over across that street, man, swinging hard. And so when we saw that, you know, we jumped in our cars and we left. And then when we came back, man, there was blood everywhere. It was awful. It was really, really, really bad. So, you know, obviously there was a big uproar and it got really bad. We played at Martin Luther, California Avenue Park, you know, to try to, you know, calm everybody down, I think a day or two after. And, you know, there were some Molotov cocktails thrown at some white people that drove by. I don't know what that was about. And then I remember the cops stopping me as I was walking down the street, and they threatened me and had me in the car, and you know, I was smart enough to say, yes, sir, no, sir, yes, sir, you know. It was awful. It was awful.
That's horrible to face that when everyone is just trying to play music and have a good time, to deal with violence like that, especially from the people that are supposed to protect you.
Right.
Yeah, so I've read a little bit about this incident in Daniel Rios's thesis. Also, Oliver Rosales wrote a book called Civil Rights in Bakersfield, Segregation and Multiracial Activism in the Central Valley. And it does really talk a lot about in that book about people from different cultures working together on the East Side to try to fix some of the problems with racism and violence in Bakersfield. But in chapter 6, it talks about this incident. After this incident, three black teenagers, Brooks, Johnson, and Larkin, were all on trial for attacking the police, even though all the witnesses said that they didn't. And multiple officers testified that they did attack the police. But one officer, Steve Powers, testified that the police were trying to make up a story and that that's not what happened. He said that he wouldn't compromise his integrity and he resigned from the BPD. And even with that testimony, the jury voted to convict these three teenagers. I think that's never been, that injustice has never been fixed.
Oh, it was terrible. What started that was someone threw a beer bottle in the middle of California Avenue. I'm an eyewitness to it, for sure.
And that officer's dad was a police chief here in the 30s and 40s. He was the chief of the Bakersfield Police Department. They kind of got ran out of town, and they talked to the Fresno Bee, and he said that Bakersfield is a sociologically backward community, a racist community, where police can be used to harass private citizens. I don't want Bakersfield to be like that. I want Bakersfield to be a good place for everyone.
Yeah, I agree, but it wasn't. The one thing I know, there was a lot of solidarity on the East Side. There was a lot of great music. And, you know, when you mentioned the Cotton Club, I have to say, too, the Elks used to bring in a lot of great acts as well.
Nice.
I remember Clarence Carter. It's been so long. I mean, it's been, 60 years?
Yeah.
You know, I can't remember. But I know that I got, even though this was in Los Angeles, you know, where the music scene was obviously much greater, we did have great music artists come through this town and play in, you know, on Lakeview Avenue or Cottonwood or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, and that's cool. In spite of the adversity that you were facing, you could have quit music and said, I'm done after this. But you didn't. You kept going. You didn't let it stop you. And just because if we live in a town that does have problems doesn't mean we can't try to build it up in our own way, our own communities, our own families and stuff.
Well, I mean, when I think about the music scene in the 60s and the 70s here, you know, when I say 60s, I'm talking about, you know, mid-60s to mid-70s, that 10-year span. That's my time here. And you had some great musicians in this town, like Sylvester Lyons back, you know, and there was a guitar player named Billy Molan, Gene Lothridge, Good Time Charlie, all of these people, you know, there were just great, great musicians. And unfortunately, some left, like Charles Weldon, and made a name for himself in New York. And, you know, and Johnny Gomez. Johnny Gomez is, you know, he was the jazz guy, the jazz Hispanic guy of Bakersfield. And then, you know, by working with the Hispanic community, there was a lot of great Hispanic musicians here, you know, like Johnny Gomez and, let me think, Philip Castaneda, Lalo Castaneda, and Nino Macias, Robert Calvillo. I mean, I could go on and on and on and on. But these were all, I mean, there was a lot of music on the east side and a lot of good musicians.
That's cool. This probably happened after you left, but why did some of the clubs close in the 70s?
When I left, man, I don't know what it was, but, you know, it got violent here. When I left, there was, you know, there was shootings. The Cotton Club was, you know, was a dangerous place to go. The Elks was probably, there was another place called the Checkmate that was on Union Avenue. That was okay, but I mean, I remember playing there and then, you know, watching, you know, gunfire, you know, all around. Right in the 70s, I was working in a lot of the white clubs, like the Dungeon on Railroad. Right. Well, the Dungeon was well, I mean, you know, when I say white, no, it was, I think everybody was starting to get away from the east side. You know, they were, you know, I guess people were becoming a little bit more mobile or,
okay,
you know, or something. But the Dungeon, there was another club on Oak Street. I can't think of the name of it. There was the Matchmaker, which, you know, that was not a place of people of color could go.
Okay.
But I played there, and I feared for my safety whenever I played there. I really did. But that's where I met my wife.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, by that time, right before I left, I was working a lot more of the white clubs in town. And you know, people, you know, of color were starting to branch out a little bit more. And then you had the Tam O'Shanter. I'm sure you've heard of that.
The what?
The Tam O'Shanter.
No, I haven't.
Well, the Tam O'Shanter is right up here on Alta Vista. Lamucci's Tam O'Shanter. And that was another a venue that brought out of town acts. And you also had obviously Mason Josso's. You've heard of that, right?
No.
Okay.
I didn't know.
Well, I mean, Mason Josso, well, it's now a casino down on South Union by the fairground.
Oh, okay. That used to be a club?
That used to be Mason Josso's. That was like the place where they had all of, they had.
And that was in the 70s when you're saying that was mm-hmm. the place? Okay, cool.
60s.
Oh, 60s
too? Yeah, 60s and 70s. And then you had the Lost Night. That's what it was, the Lost Night on okay. Oak Street. So, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of music back then, a lot of places to, you know, to play. And, you know, after Cottonwood or Lakewood, Lakeview Avenue, whatever you want to call it, after it started getting really dangerous.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even want to, you know, I wasn't going around there then. Except the Elks. Elks has always been a home base.
Nice. Oh, I should ask, what did your family think of you being a musician?
Well, funny story, you know, when I was playing music, everybody used to say, boy, why don't you get yourself a real job? Why don't you quit messing around with that music? You ain't gonna ever be nothing about nothing. You know, you're going to be, you know, you're worthless. So I listened to that, you know, and I went to, back in the day, they had what they called a job corps. And so I went to the Job Corps, and I studied electronics, or electricity probably back then. And because of affirmative action, I got a job at AT&T. At that time, it was called Western Electric. But it's now AT&T, same company. And boy, you know, that's a job where I could have retired and had two homes and a motorhome and, you know, a pension and everything. I think I lasted 3 months and I quit it for a six-nighter. And they thought that I had lost my mind.
Your parents?
Well,
your grandparents?
Yeah, great-grandparents. They thought I just completely lost my mind, that I wasn't going to ever be anything. And the whole family, you know, all family members. But then when I left and I got the job with Tina Turner and I'm Traveling the World, they all said, oh, I knew you were going to do this. I knew you were going to do this. And I said, yeah, right. Thanks for the support, you know. So
yeah,
they didn't think too much of my musical career in the beginning.
So how did that happen? You were playing in the original Souls and then you went to Tina Turner. That was your next gig?
Unfortunately, the original souls, you know, we were popular all the way up until 75, 76. Unfortunately, drugs got involved. So the band disbanded. And so I decided, okay, well, I want to become, you know, I still want to play music, and I know that I have to leave town in order to pursue my career. And I moved to Los Angeles and found out that I wasn't nowhere near up to snuff. So I was in a room like this, and I'd spend 6, 7, 8 hours a day practicing. And just so happens, a good friend of mine from Delano called me one day. He had moved to Los Angeles. He was a bass player. His name is Charles Sarcida, very good bass player. He called me. He said, "Hey, man, I got a job with Tina Turner." He says, "But my wife and I talked about it. We have 3 small children, and I have to turn it down. So would you, you know, you want to, you know, go audition for Tina Turner?" I said, "Yeah." So, you know, he told me what he auditioned. And so I went into my practice mode and practiced, and I got the job. And I was only in Los Angeles 8 months before I got the job with Tina Turner.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was that like playing with Tina Turner?
I told Robert Price that, you know, Tina Turner was not only my boss, she was my mentor and sometimes my mother. She, you know, she knew that I was, you know, green as far as being a professional musician. She took special care for me. She loaned me the money to bring my wife on a 3-month tour of Europe. And
wow.
You know, and it was great. I mean, she was great. She was very family oriented. We all, it was a family. In fact, we, you know, all of the we're forever friends. All of the musicians that I play with that are still alive, we're like family, just like family for sure.
So you were in her band from 1977 to 1981.
Mm-hmm.
So you toured all through Europe and the United States, right?
Mm-hmm. In that time? And Australia, New Zealand.
Wow.
You know, everywhere.
What was it like playing live for that many people?
The largest crowd I've ever played for is 20,000.
That's a lot.
That was in Caracas, Venezuela. To be honest, man, you know, 10 rows deep, you don't see nothing. Yeah.
It's the same.
Yeah. Yeah. 10 rows deep is, that's it. Then it's just.
That makes sense. So you went from there to playing with Lou Rawls, right?
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen?
Well, we were opening for Lou.
Okay.
You know, and well, we were doing a lot of Vegas back in those days. And Vegas was really happening back in those days. We were working Vegas quite a bit. We were working Caesar's Palace and the Hilton and different things like that. And for some reason, we were opening for Lou Rawls. Lou Rawls was very famous at that time because he had that hit record, You'll Never Find.
Okay.
And so we got to be, because we worked so much with him, we got to be friends with, you know, their band and our band, Tina's band. We all became friends. As a matter of fact, one of the dancers married Lou Rawls' bass player. When that bass player decided to leave Lou Rawls to go with Glen Campbell, he asked me if I wanted to, you know, be in Lou's band. For some reason, I thought, I'll never forget this. For some reason, because Lou worked mostly in the United States, and with Tina, we were all over the world. And I felt, okay, well, if I play with Lou, then I could be closer to my kids, you know, because I wouldn't be, you know, that far away.
Yeah.
But trust me, man, if you're on the road and you're in New York, it's no different being in New York and being in Japan.
I see.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. You're still gone.
You're still gone. You know, and, you know, I won't say this, but Lou's band did not have the camaraderie that Tina's band had. You know, I made a lot more money. In fact, I was even on retainer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You know, I mean, my wife and I, we had a brand new Volvo. And I mean, you know, we bought a house. I mean, we were doing just fine.
That's good.
Financially. But musically, I missed the camaraderie.
Yeah.
You know, that camaraderie that we had with Tina.
because of the simple fact that I was Tina's first bass player as a solo artist. Because when I got with Tina, she had just left Ike. We were there to help her.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think we did a pretty good job.
That's good.
You know, she became one of the world's most famous people.
Yeah.
And I've, you know, and there's a documentary on HBO that I'm in.
Oh, you are? That's cool.
Yeah. So I'm in that documentary.
I'll have to look that up. So after Lou Rawls, you went on Star Search with Pressure Point. Is that right?
Yeah. Actually, how that started, there was a drummer here in town named Randy Sears. I got him a job with Tina. And then there was a guitar player named Marty Townsend. And what we did, we had a trio here in Bakersfield. I moved back to Bakersfield for a period. And what we did is we had a trio, and then we would bring in musicians from L.A. And we brought in this guy by the name of Sonny Charles, who was famous, you know, he had a couple of hit records. And then we would bring in, like, the background singers from the Righteous Brothers, and we would back them up.
Wow.
So Sonny introduced us to some girls. One was actually the wife of the baseball player Steve Yeager from the Dodgers. And she was with Steely Dan and Andy Williams and all of that. So they were all professionals. And so we put a band together. And one of them knew Leslie Uggams. I think Leslie Uggams' claim to fame now is a bunch of Star Wars things that she's in. And so her and her husband and Dionne Warwick managed us. And so without an audition or anything, the next thing we knew, we were on Star Search.
Wow.
You know. It's who you know.
Yeah.
And so we got on Star Search, and we made it all the way to the finals, and we lost. And so that was the end of that, I mean, as far as I was concerned, because I think we lost because of drugs.
You know. It's the classic musician story,
right.
Band story.
Mm-hmm. After that, I decided to go out on my own.
Is that when you went to Europe and started touring all over?
After that, I got in with this guy from Delano.
Oh, yeah. What's his name?
Little Ray.
Little Ray, nice.
Have you heard of Little Ray?
No.
He did a really good... He had a hit song when he was 13 called I Who Have Nothing.
Okay, that's cool.
Right. And you can find it on YouTube.
Yeah, I'll check it out.
He got into the East L.A. R&B scene. And he got with, you know, the Midnighters, and, you know, he's excellent vocalist out of Delano. But anyway, after I left the Star Search band, he had what we call a casual band. And he did a lot of, you know, fancy parties in Beverly Hills and Hollywood and things like that. And then... clubs. He would do clubs during the week, and then he would do private parties on the weekends. And I saw that I was making a decent living, you know, doing, you know, we'd play these $100 nightclubs three nights a week, and then we'd make, you know, maybe another $500 for the weekend. So I was bringing in $800-$900 a week just doing clubs and these private gigs. And so then he had so much work that he wanted an offshoot band. And so he hired me to become a band leader to do, you know, a lot of the work.
Yeah.
And then he was a little oppressive, you know, and I wasn't making what I knew that, you know, we were being, you know.
Yeah, you knew the money side.
Yeah, I knew the money side. So I said, well, you know what? I think I want to go out on my own. And so what I did is I told anybody that had hired me, I said, if you want me, I said, I'm no longer affiliated with Breakthrough Artists. If you want my show, you need to call me. And I became a society band leader. I was doing rap parties for ABC. I was doing all kinds of great things, and I made a great living. And then what happened was I realized that I had played three weddings for the same family. I had did all three of their children's weddings. And that's not how I wanted to go out. I mean, I had done the Playboy Mansion. I did it all as far as the L.A. scene is concerned. And then I got a call to go to the Middle East, to Bahrain. I dropped everything and put my band, you know, I took my band. I said, whoever wants to go, let's go. And so we went to Bahrain, and we were very successful in Bahrain. Then I got a call to go back to Bahrain, and then we went to Oman and was very successful. And then we went to the UAE, and then we went to Croatia. I mean, we were all over the place. And then I got a call from a guy that I knew in the Middle East and said, hey, I want you to come to the Netherlands and play and help me build this club. And so we went to the Netherlands.
And this is in the 90s?
90s, yeah. Well, the 90s for the Middle East and okay. The early 2000s for Europe.
Okay.
You know, and then also after that, I became a entertainment director for a hotel in Phnom Penh, Cambodia.
Wow.
So, you know, and then after that, I came back home.
And that's your blues era, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, in L.A. Yes,
yeah. Oh, that's right. You saw that one. And that was in Belgium, that gig. And what I would do is like that guy that was singing on that video that you sent, his name is Lucky Lloyd. He's a blues guitar player. And so what I did, I had a bunch of Dutch musicians. All of those guys were Dutch musicians. And we would back up American artists.
Wow.
Over there.
So did you go to L.A. and study more of the blues?
Yeah, I did. Right? Yeah. Yeah. I that was in between work in the Middle East and moving to Europe.
Okay.
So during that time, I realized, see, the thing about it, even though blues is simple, like three chords and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That doesn't make you a blues player because you know how to play three chords.
Yeah.
And I knew that when I played the blues that I didn't really know what I was doing. So the only way for me to figure out how to play the blues is to go play the blues. So I got with this guy named J.J. Bad Boy Jones. He was about my age now. He was like 76, 77 years old, blues guitar player. And I got with him, and I started playing the blues, and I got into the blues circuit. And then I started working with this guy named Roy Gaines. He had a few hit records, and we went to Switzerland. We went to Paris. We were all over the place playing the blues, met B.B. King in Paris.
Wow, that's cool.
You know, and we did blues festivals everywhere, all over the U.S. and Europe and everything else. So I became, you know, quite the blues guy. And that's where I met Pauly Serra. You know, when I moved back to America after my 8-year stint in Europe, that's when I started working with Pauly Serra.
And this would have been, what year did you move back, do you think?
2010.
Yeah, then you worked with Pauly Serra Band. Then you started playing at the Crystal Palace, right?
Right.
You hadn't been a part of Bakersfield Sound at all, and all of a sudden now you're playing with the Buckaroos.
Right. Yeah. Well, it was, how did that happen? You know, the funny part about that is that, you know, I played with this blues guy named Swamp Dog.
Oh, yeah. I saw you were on that album, The White Man Made Me Do It, right?
Why, you did your research.
I tried my best.
Yeah. Yeah. The White Man Made. He still owes me for that album.
Oh, man.
Yeah, he still owes me. The cool thing about Swamp Dog is that we did this, that right there, that Art Rhythm and Blues Festival, Tell It Like It Is, June 30th through July 4th and on the National Mall for the Smithsonian.
Ooh, the Smithsonian. Yeah. The National Mall in Washington, D.C. then?
Yeah, right.
That is cool.
Yeah, so we did that. As well as us, there was Stax people. You know,
ooh, Stax Records.
Stax Records was there. All of these people, Mabel King, all of these people, all these old R&B people, and also the Funk Brothers.
Ooh,
you know,
yeah,
and
they're good.
You remember the Funk Brothers. They did all of the Motown records. You know, that was a bittersweet moment for me because, you know, knowing that the Funk Brothers were on there, knowing that, you know, that the work, the body of work that they had done, I could not wait to go and hear them and to meet them. So and on the National Mall, they had like about three or four tents set up, three or four venues where people would go and see these acts.
Oh, so, kind of like the different stages at a show?
Right.
What do they call it? Festival stages?
Right. There were different stages in tents. We were finishing our show, and the Funk Brothers were getting ready to start. And I wanted to go see the Funk Brothers, and especially to go see Bob Babbitt. Bob Babbitt was one of the Funk Brothers bass players. It was him and James Jamerson who did the majority of all of those, you know, tracks for Motown. But unfortunately, Bob Babbitt had brain cancer. And so when I went to go see him play, they were playing Ain't Too Proud to Beg. And the song is in C, and poor Bob was playing in C sharp and even know he was playing in C sharp. And come to find out is that, you know, the brain cancer was really taking effect on him. And they asked me to finish out the concert series, which had 8 shows left.
With the Funk Brothers, wow.
With the Funk Brothers. So I did that. And it was so great because what it was so cool is that when I do my show with Swamp Dogg, right? As soon as I finished, there would be a golf cart waiting to take me to the next tent to go play with the Funk Brothers, you know? And so I made double money that gig. But it was bittersweet because I was taking Bob Babbitt's place, you know? To make a long story just a little shorter, is that after I did that, 2 weeks later, they called me to play at the Crystal Palace.
Okay.
You know, and I thought to myself, wow, you know, 2 weeks ago I was playing with the Funk Brothers. Now I'm playing with the Buckaroos. And what I did is I went, you know, I went to the Crystal Palace and I listened to Doyle play and learned how to play country music. I didn't just go in there and, you know, just use my own thing. I try to respect any music I play. But it's not about me. I thought.
Who was playing in the Crystal Palace with you? Who was in the Buckaroos at the time?
Well, it was Jim Shaw. And
he helped with your new album, didn't
he? Yes, he did. Yeah, he wrote some songs. We became close friends. Jim and I are close friends now. Terry Cap. I can't remember Terry's last name, but he was the guitar steel player.
Yeah.
With Buck. And that was pretty much it for the Buck. Well, Dave Wolfkeeler was the drummer he was the last drummer for Buck. So he's technically a Buckaroo as well.
Yeah.
So there was 3 Buckaroos that I was playing with. And I took Doyle's place because Doyle's ears got real sensitive. He went to a gun range and started target practicing with no, you know.
Protection.
No protection.
Uh-oh.
And so that's what led. And then Monty Byram was actually the one that was fronting the Buckaroos at that time.
Oh, okay.
And he was the one that recommended me to take Doyle's place.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
Well, not about his ears, of course, but yeah. Okay, this is a random one, but so I know you sometimes play a 4-string, but I've seen clips of you playing a 5-string bass. When did you change that up?
That's recently. I've kind of taken a hiatus from playing for the last couple of years to take care of some family business.
Yeah.
And then when I decided to, you know, after I released my album, I haven't even released it. I'll be releasing it this month.
Oh, cool.
And I decided, you know, I've been playing 5-strings since, say, 1990. And because, you know, back then, you know, they had the synthesizers with the low Bs, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so in order to become competitive, I got the 5-string. It was hard in the beginning, but then I got used to it. And I still love the 5-string. But then I decided that I wanted to go back to old school.
Yeah.
And this is just recently. I took this bass and I completely I changed all of this stuff, and I put, you know, all top of the line gear on it.
Nice.
And I decided that I'm going to go this 4-string jazz bass and my 5-string. And I might pull out the precision, depending. But it's going to be the jazz. I was a jazz bass player, Fender jazz bass player.
Yeah.
Then I went to the G&L, which is basically a glorified Fender, you know, because it's made by Leo Fender and George Fullerton.
Oh, nice.
Fullerton. So it's basically a Fender bass, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but this is going to be my go-to bass.
Nice.
And I'll use the 5-string for specialty songs.
We should talk about your new album. That's what you've done the most recently musically, right? Love is the Cure?
Yes, sir.
How was that? Did you write that? You wrote those songs here in the studio that we're in?
Well, Love is the Cure, it's kind of funny how this thing came together. I went to gym with some original material, some music and lyrics, just to get his opinion.
Yeah.
He didn't really like my lyrics. So what he did, he took the music and he rewrote the lyrics, and all of a sudden we became good friends, and the music worked. My music and his lyrics worked, and he decided to help me put it together. And so what I decided to do was take 6 songs of cover songs that most people knew and put my spin on them, and then I would take these other 6 songs, original songs, which Jim was very instrumental in doing, and every song has a meaning. Every of the original songs, they have a personal meaning. Promise is about being true to yourself and true to your loved one and having integrity about who you are as a person. You know, the lyrics, you know, my promise means forever and to stand the test of time. Is that when you give your word, that's your word, and especially to a loved one. And Walk the Walk was sort of like a protest song because I saw some hypocrisy in life where people were talking, basically saying, you know, do as I say and not as I do. If you're going to talk the talk, you got to walk the walk, you know. So that's what's that all about. Let a Little Light In. It's about racism, but it's in a different way. It's basically saying, to be honest, I'm gonna just be candid. You know, this was sort of like a thing to say to liberal, open-minded white people to speak out when you see racism. You know, let a little light in, open up a heart, try to get these people to understand that, you know, we're all the same. We're in this together. You know. Messing Around is about meeting my wife and the relationship that we had. And Love is the Cure. Well, it's about just loving your fellow man, you know, just, you know, don't think that you're above anybody else. So, I mean, I would hope that this, I mean, and that's why the name of the album is called Love is the Cure, because at the end of the day, man, I've been all over the world. And it doesn't matter where I go. If you show love to an individual, that's what they want. That's what anybody wants, just to be loved and respected. And that's what this album is all about. It's about just loving your fellow man. You know, that's how I live my life. I mean, I would treat a homeless person with the same respect as I would, you know, a judge or, you know, or anybody else, you know. So that's me. And then plus, it was sort of like an homage to the musicians that I've met throughout my career, because I have some of the greatest musicians in the world on that record. The drummer on 6 of the tracks is James Gatson, who's been on over 500 gold records.
Wow.
You know, 500 gold records. You know, he was the drummer for Bill Withers. All of those hits, he was the drummer on.
So back to the Grandma's Hands that we talked about, he probably played on that one.
Probably
we talked
did.
That about at the beginning. That's
right.
Cool.
Yeah. And, You know, I mean, he did Sexual Healing by Marvin Gaye.
Marvin Gaye, whoa.
And he did Dancing Machine by Michael Jackson. I mean, he's done, I mean, he's on a lot.
500, that's amazing.
It's amazing, yes, it is. And there's a pianist on there by the name of Clarence McDonald. Bruce Conte from Tower of Power, the guitar player,
oh, wow.
is on there. There's another guitarist. I mean, he's an unsung. He's one of the behind-the-scenes guy by the name of Daryl Crooks, but he was with the Gap Band and just an amazing, you know, guitarist. A good friend of mine, Bob Farrell, who was a musical director for the Temptations and the Four Tops. Just incredible musicians. So it's an homage because a lot of the music, most of the songs, they all have solos because I feature the musicians as well.
That's cool.
That's what this album is about. It's about loving mankind and my respect and homage to the musicians that I've met throughout my career. The rhythm section, the rhythm section has got to be 65 plus in age.
That's cool.
It's a good album.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for giving me a copy. It's awesome. I'm excited to listen to it.
On the back of it, I had to pay homage to Tina.
Oh, wow.
You know, and that picture there means so much to me because if you really look at that picture, you'll see the love between the two of us. I will never forget her for what she brought to my life. You know, it's not for me. This picture is not about, hey, I play with Tina Turner. I'm saying that this woman had a tremendous influence on me as a person and as a musician. That's no joke. That's what this is about. And I said to Tina, a huge and wonderful part of my life has nothing to do with the fact that she's world-renowned Tina Turner. It's all to do with what she, the influence she had on me. So this is almost like a bio. Really, it's almost like a bio.
That's awesome, though. You've done so much in your career. You know, I'm so impressed. When you look back, what's the top three shows that you played?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I can think of two.
Okay.
And if I think of my time with Tina, there's too many aha moments.
Yeah.
You know, that I don't think have anything to do with music.
What are some of those moments?
I'll give you the first two that doesn't have anything to do with Tina. One of the greatest moments I've had performing was I performed at a Cambodian orphanage. That's one of the highlights of my career, was to play that orphanage. The other was the Lake Ming Battle of the Bands.
Yeah.
With those 4,000, 3,000 people, and the majority of them was our fan base because of the meaning behind what we were doing that night. And the other aha moment was with Tina. We were working at the Westbury Music Fair in Long Island, New York, and we were on a theater in the round, you know, and it turns, you know, the audience is, you know, is all around you, and it turns. And so we were performing, we were kicking butt, and Tina's top fell.
Oh, no.
And so she grabbed it like this, and she went to go run off the stage. But I guess because the stage was moving, she lost her balance. So as soon as she got to where the stage, you know, as soon as she got off the stage, she tripped and fell, you know, and had to do like that, and once again exposed herself. And so she went up to, you know, there was a quick change booth because she did costume changes in between, you know, some songs. And, man, I mean, first of all, when the top fell, you know, the audience, us, the band members, I mean, we were just, oh, geez, you know, I mean, we were just so embarrassed for her. We were just, you know, and you could see the audience. They were, you know, they were feeling bad for her too. And then when she fell, it was even worse, man. I mean, it was so... The atmosphere was just, you know, this heavy cloud came over the whole
Yeah.
The theater, you know. And then she came back, man. She came back like if nothing ever happened. She killed it. And, man, I can tell you, whatever it was that she brought back, it charged us like never before. And, I mean, we just went into hyper mode. We had a kick-ass show. And the audience just, I mean, it was the electricity in that theater that night was, I've never experienced anything like it since.
Wow.
You know, never experienced anything like it since. And right then and there, that told me, you know, that this, you know, this show business thing is a serious thing. You know, it's not about you. It's not about you as an individual. It's about your art and your trade, to bring the people together. I mean, seriously, man, it was amazing to see that, because I know how I felt, and I knew I could see it on everybody else. But when she came back, like if nothing ever happened and just kicked butt, we were right there with her. It's been amazing. Those are the 20,000, none of that stuff really matter, you know. I mean, we've done some things, I've done everything, but those three incidents mean a lot. All the other stuff was gigs.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Tina Turner sounds like a badass.
Badass. You know, in the documentaries, they always say, when I was with Tina, they called it her cabaret years, you know, when she left Ike until the point to where she made it. You know, I think I posted something one time and said, you know, this may have been her cabaret years, but we were the best cabaret band in the world. You know.
Yeah.
We were the best cabaret band in the world. I'll stand to that. And I'm honored to have been a part of that.
Is there anything that you wanted to talk about that I didn't ask about?
No, not really, man. You've pretty much covered my career. That's for sure. You know, I mean, back to, you know, the Cottonwood days. And the East, when you say Cottonwood and, you know, that Lakeview thing, I just really feel that it would be an injustice not to mention just the whole East Side itself.
Yeah.
There was so much going on, you know, music wise. I mean, good musicians and, you know.
I think you called it the East Bakersfield sound, right?
Yeah, that's right. It was, it was an amazing culture back then. An amazing culture.
So at the end of the show, I always like to shout out local artists. And I want to hear, what local artists do you want to shout out? Besides yourself, of course.
Jim Shaw. I call him the color man. Not colored man, but color man. He has a sensitivity about what he does on his keyboards that enhances the whole thing. He's a very sensitive musician. That's who I give a shout out to. I mean, there's more. Johnny Gomez, if I don't know if I'd have become a musician without Johnny Gomez. You know, he was very instrumental in my career for sure. And he's still around kicking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Still around.
I'll have to talk to him.
Please do.
So, what about this? What about any past artists that just didn't get their credit? I mean, there's probably a book of those, right? But anyone that you haven't mentioned or that you want to shout out again for emphasis even?
When you say artists, you mean local artists?
Yeah, I mean local artists, I guess I would say.
Man, I mean, yeah, I mean, the list is way too long.
Yeah.
I mean, the list is way too long. I mean, Sylvester, I mean, when you gave me this picture of Johnny Guitar Watson and Sylvester Lyons, you know, I talk about my days as being in the house band, but I have to remember that he was in the house band way before me and the people that he backed up, Sylvester Lyons, Billy Molan. Let me think. Sylvester Lyons, Billy Molan, Elsie Killebrew, Marion Gatson, Eugene Lothridge, Al Garcia and the Rhythm Kings, you know, Al Garcia, Manuel Garcia, Raymond Mojica. Just a ton of people, man.
Yeah.
Just great musicians that never really got, they never went anywhere, but I mean, they were great musicians. I mean, there was a group called the Gay Lads, the Diamonds, and all of these bands that were, I mean, I don't know, maybe, you know, I didn't realize, I was too young to realize their prowess, but to me, they were just fantastic.
I'm just excited. This has been so fun for me. I hope it's fun for you.
Well, I mean, you've taken me down memory lane. Are you kidding?
Sidewalk, a passerby gives what he can. A mother's baby cries all night, but a neighbor lends a hand. The new kid's sad and lonely, but someone's smile is near. Add up all the pictures, and I think it's really clear. Why can't we see to be truly free? The answer lies in you and me. It's love, it's the cure. Oh, oh, love, it will endure. It's a love so sweet and pure. The one thing in this world we know for sure, love is the cure.